Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Seattle reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist, Dr. Paul Lynn. Our topic is in vitro fertilization and newer developments in the management of infertility. Dr. Lynn works at Seattle Reproductive Medicine. We have a link to that site on our website if you'd like to get more information. He did his undergraduate, or I'm sorry, his medical training at Albany College in New York, then went to Boston for residency training in obstetrics and gynecology at Tufts, then moved a little bit further west to Louisville for training in reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and then moved to Seattle. Dr. Lynn, welcome to Line One.
Hi, Thad. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're just great. Understand, you're getting snow and we're getting ice. Sorry to hear that for you guys.
Yeah, no, we're doing fine, just fine down here.
So let me remind everybody how to get a hold of us. That's what I should do first, I guess. In Anchorage, if you've got questions or comments today, our local number 550-8433. 550-8433. As you know, we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email us during the program at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. All right, Dr. Lynn, let's do this. Let's frame this topic today by taking us through maybe the menstrual cycle of a woman and pregnancy, and throw in these hormonal things, because we're going to be talking about estrogens and progesterone and so forth. So we got some frame of reference about all of this.
Sure, sure. You know, a woman has obviously cycles, menstrual flow, which act as the landmark from one cycle to the next. And it's basically divided into three specific events. So right after a woman has her menstrual flow, which typically lasts for 4 or 5 days, she starts to develop an egg. And that egg develops over a span of 13, 14 days. It varies for women, but in general, that's how it works. And then there is the development of estrogen. That egg develops estrogen through the early part of that cycle, and that estrogen increases over that time course. And then eventually the brain recognizes this and releases a hormone called luteinizing hormone, which is a hormone that releases that egg that has been developing. And this comes from a part of the brain called the pituitary, and it's actually what most women who are trying to get pregnant measure when they buy those ovulation predictor kits. It's actually measuring luteinizing hormone production, and it tells a woman, you know, when to have intercourse. Once the egg then ovulates, which usually occurs within a day or two after that surge, progesterone is produced by the resulting egg that has ovulated. And it's that progesterone that develops the uterus. So the lining is building up, it's getting thicker, and then the progesterone produces a lining that makes it conducive for the fertilized egg to implant on the uterus. And then pregnancy occurs, and if pregnancy occurs, the woman misses her period or is late for a period, and she continues on with the pregnancy with progesterone being produced supporting that pregnancy. If the woman doesn't get pregnant, the progesterone regresses, and as a result of the drop in the progesterone, she has another menstrual flow, and the whole cycle starts again.
Hmm. Okay. One of the questions that I have, and I've commented on the patients every once in a while, is the relative inefficiency of pregnancies, and I'd like to just verify that or get your opinion. And by asking, what percentage of actual in vivo fertilizations, eggs that get fertilized in the woman and become a pregnancy, end in a viable newborn? How efficient is this process?
Oh, it's terribly inefficient. It's surprising to people how inefficient reproduction is. I mean, if you really think about it from a biological standpoint, women are they are born with their allotment of eggs, and that never gets any higher than that, and that stands at around 7 million eggs. 7 million eggs. And by the time you ovulate and gone through every single menstrual cycle that you're going to have until menopause, you've gone through about 400 eggs. So of the 7 million, only 400 of those eggs have actually ovulated. And what happens to the rest? They undergo what we call programmed cell death. Apoptosis is the word. Mm-hmm. And that's very, very inefficient system. And then of those 400 eggs that a woman ovulates, they might, if they don't use contraception throughout the course of their life, might have only like 4 or 5 kids. So if you really think about it, of the 7 million eggs, you're probably talking about a less than 1% chance that that egg is actually going to result in a live birth. With in vitro, we do increase it, definitely. But look at the baseline that we're coming from. At 7.5% to 10% per egg live birth, it doesn't sound that much as a number itself, but relative to natural conception, it's huge, huge.
How about in real life, in vivo, when women are fertilized, when the egg is fertilized in their fallopian tubes, what percentage of those actually make it to a newborn infant? Do we know that?
We don't know that, actually. You know, from the time that sperm deposition occurs in natural conception to, you know, how many eggs are actually getting fertilized all along the way, outside of in vitro fertilization, which is what we do a lot to help women get pregnant, we don't know what the efficiency pattern is that occurs naturally. Mm-hmm. Naturally. But we do know that in a woman's first year of trying to get pregnant, with no other factors out there, they have about a 20 to 25% chance of getting pregnant. And then, depending on their age, they probably take-home baby, they probably will result in a 20% chance, 15% chance of having a baby with no other factors preventing them from getting pregnant.
Hmm. Okay.
And that's best-case scenario.
Okay. I remind our listeners again, if you've got questions or comments today about infertility or in vitro fertilization, that's what we're going to be talking about. My guest is Dr. Paul Lynn, who works in Seattle at Seattle Reproductive Medicine. He's a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist. You can reach him by calling 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is lineone@kska.org. When I looked at your website, there was something you all do called fertility assessment, and I'd like you to, if you wouldn't mind, take us through that and why that might be important for people to know about.
Sure. It stems from when Dr. Soles, my partner, when he was president of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, he created this huge, huge campaign to make women aware of their fertility status, regardless of whether they were trying to get pregnant or not. We wanted to make women aware of their own fertility status. Because we know that age is the underlying factor to every woman's struggle. It's something that we cannot change. We can give women drugs, we can do in vitro fertilization, we can do a lot of things technically to improve a woman's ability to get pregnant, but age is something that we can't change. And what we've done down here is, stemming from that campaign, is try to offer a program that we offer to many women, where they can get the major information about their fertility status. There are a few simple tests that we can do, hormonal tests that we can do, blood tests that we can do, an ultrasound that we can do to give a woman an idea of how, quote-unquote, fertile she is at that stage. Even though she's not trying, it gives her an idea of, with some simple tests and a simple visit with one of us down here in Seattle or a phone consultation, we can give them an idea of how fertile they are, so they can do their appropriate family planning.
Hmm. So it requires, an ultrasound to get an idea of the number of eggs and then some blood tests?
Yes. Yes. So the blood test, specifically what we're checking is follicle stimulating hormone, otherwise known as FSH. We have tons of acronyms here in reproductive medicine, but FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, is one of the tests. Estradiol is another test. These are all just simple blood draws, usually done on one stick. There's another hormone that we check called anti-Müllerian hormone, which comes directly from the eggs themselves, along with a vaginal ultrasound where we can literally morphologically look at a woman's ovaries, count the number of quote-unquote follicles called antrofollicles, and give them an idea of how fertile they are with this litany of fertility tests.
So you can actually, you said there's something like in the neighborhood of 7 million eggs, so you, I would imagine you can't count all those, but there's a way you can tell by the follicles themselves how
That's right.
how many are what, viable or functional?
Yeah. Well, and viability, no, not necessarily viability, or people often ask us quality. Does it tell us quality of those? No, this is a quantitative assessment, and indirectly we're able to assess their quality. But it's a quantitative assessment, and simply put, if you have more eggs available that we can see on the ovaries, you're going to be, quote-unquote, more fertile. But we know it's a little bit more complicated than that, Thad, but it gives them an idea. You know, if their number is on the borderline or if it's on the low side, it gives that woman empowerment of their own fertility status, and they may decide to do something about it, or they may not decide not to do anything about it. What we're trying to do down here in Seattle with this fertility assessment program is empower women with their own knowledge about their own fertility, so that they can have, they can make the decision for themselves. Oftentimes, we see lots of women who come to us and they have a consult and we give them these numbers. They feel like they've been gypped a bit. I wish someone had told me this before. I wish someone had done these tests before, because I would have done something different about it. And that's what we're trying to do with this fertility assessment program, is offer a very simple approach, something that is easy, and we can give these women the empowerment that they have knowledge about what their fertility status is.
And is that where the term ovarian reserve comes from?
Yes. Yeah, so ovarian reserve, egg reserve, what's the reserve? Because we know that as time goes along, that reserve, that egg quantity, that egg quality is going down, and oftentimes it can go down quite rapidly.
So there's, over time, there's an increased risk in general, but one particular woman may have more reserve than another woman at her age, and that can be determined pretty accurately, is what I hear you saying.
It can be determined with some fair, some accuracy. Again, no test is perfect, as you know, but certainly not knowing your numbers is probably the worst case scenario, where you're completely unaware of where you are in the spectrum of your ovarian reserve.
So a woman who is very happy in her professional life and has decided that she might want to delay pregnancy for a while might make her decision a little bit more educatively by knowing what her ovarian reserve is, what her fertility assessment
is. Exactly. These are the target audience for this kind of testing is any woman who wants to know, regardless of where she is in her professional life or where she is in her social life. I just want to know where I stand, and I'm not trying, or maybe I am. It's important to know these values so that you can make the most educated decision about what you're going to do. Wait another year, wait 5 years, you know, maybe I need to do something now. It empowers those women, because otherwise, if someone doesn't know these numbers and they continue to wait and continue to, you know, lead their very successful professional lives, they will come back to me. And unfortunately, how it works sometimes is that they soon realize that time has passed them by and they didn't have the choice. And that's what we're trying to avoid here with our fertility assessment program.
Remind our listeners once again, my guest is Dr. Paul Lynn. We're talking about fertility management, and hopefully if we have time, we'll get into some in vitro fertilization issues. These are all, basically, we're trying to talk about newer developments that have happened in the not-too-distant past. If you want to ask questions regarding these issues, 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@kska.org. I can envision that perhaps this technique might be helpful in women who might have medical problems also that might, they might worry or might actually be causing them to have less fertility. I'm thinking of something like, and maybe this is too far off the wall, like polycystic ovarian disease. Is there a role to play in individuals with other medical problems that may help them understand what their chances of getting pregnant are?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, oftentimes we do see healthy women, but, you know, a woman who has diabetes or ovarian, some type of ovarian cyst issue that they've had, endometriosis, these all predispose women to fertility issues down the road. Not necessarily guaranteed, because there are many women out there who have these kinds of issues that do fine, do absolutely just fine. And they get pregnant, and they carry on their life, and they never have to see someone like me. But and that's what we want to happen. We don't want them to see someone like me. We want them to be aware of their medical conditions that can cause and predispose to this apoptosis issue. The eggs themselves in the ovaries are very, very sensitive tissue, very sensitive cells within the body, and they are predisposed to damage. And when they are damaged, they die off, and you result in less, or they ovulate eventually, and the quality of that egg that does ovulate then results in a lower chance of getting pregnant. So we have been finding that medical conditions, hypertension, diabetes, all these common issues can predispose a woman to a struggle down the road. So that's where the fertility assessment program is very, very important. And it's not like someone has to come to me to do this fertility assessment program. A general OBGYN can certainly do these kinds of tests routinely. Anchorage has a lot of providers who's able to provide this services locally, and doesn't necessarily need to interact with someone of my level to get this testing done and at least initiate the discussion about their fertility status.
So certainly I would think the blood testing is available, but even the technology to do the intravaginal ultrasounds and interpret those is available here.
Yes, yes. We work with many Anchorage providers who are able to refer patients to the appropriate facility to have this work done. We've done, over the last 10, 11 years that I've been in the area, we've been able to train, quote-unquote, and get our ultrasonography friends to do this work, and we rely on them heavily to provide that information to us down here in Seattle, because we're trying to avoid people from coming down here all the time because of the distance factor. So these resources, these tests are readily available locally in the Anchorage area.
Unless you have more we need to talk about the fertility assessment issue, I want to move on. I've got a question here. It says, what is fertility preservation? What does that mean, and how does that relate to what we're talking about?
Well, fertility preservation, there are two basic scopes that it means, one of which we're doing readily. Fertility preservation, when a woman has been unfortunately diagnosed with some type of cancer, Hodgkin's, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and they're faced with some chemotherapy or radiation therapy or some type of oncologic treatment that will result in egg destruction. We see these women locally. We talk to them about egg freezing. That's what it's talking about. We give them their options. Obviously, if there's a partner involved, we encourage them to go the embryo freezing route. But if they're not in a relationship, egg freezing is really their only way to preserve their own fertility, because otherwise, if they went through the chemotherapy and radiation therapy, they would be potentially become sterilized and not have the ability to have their own children down the road. And that's what we're doing pretty much on a regular basis. There's a medical indication for fertility preservation. The holy grail in reproductive medicine is really the ability to freeze eggs on a very successful basis, and we're not there yet, though, Thad, I must emphasize to you, where we're able to take a single woman, you know, still in her 20s, in school, law school, or doing whatever she's doing professionally, be able to freeze her eggs, store them in a bank, quote-unquote, and then carry on with her professional life, and then come back, you know, at a later time, and preserve her fertility potential as if she were, you know, in her 20s when she froze the eggs in the first place. We're not very good at that yet. We're not very good at that yet. When we take a frozen egg and we thaw it and we try to fertilize it and we try to result in a live birth down the road, those statistics that I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, where it's fertility is very wasteful, becomes even, you know, even more wasteful. Mm-hmm. So spending all that money, spending all those resources, taking all those hormone shots to obtain eggs, I want to give that woman a chance of getting pregnant with those frozen eggs. We're just not able to get there yet. And really, freezing eggs is really an experimental procedure at this stage. It's not as successful as in vitro fertilization or embryo freezing, just because the eggs themselves are very, very sensitive cells subject to damage from the freezing process.
Mm-hmm. So what I get the idea that the purpose of what fertility preservation is, and you mentioned that there's two arms to this, and one was, yeah, if I understand it, was the person who is going to have potential damage due to a disease or a treatment, you'd
right,
take those eggs and save them, and then the other is the woman who may voluntarily want to protect those eggs,
correct,
for a later use. Is that that's the,
yeah,
the issue? And the problem in both of those is this egg protection is getting better, but it's still an issue related to the freezing problem.
Oh, yes, it's definitely an issue. Eggs themselves are very, very sensitive tissue. They are very subject to damage very easily, and the freezing and the thawing of those eggs is not a benign process. It causes crystallization. It causes damage to the DNA within that egg itself. That definitely subjects it to, you know, an inability to get pregnant. Embryos have cells. There's a number of cells within them, sometimes 8 cells to 100 cells. And if you lose some of those cells, it doesn't damage the embryo to a point where it makes it completely non-viable like it does with an egg.
Mm-hmm.
So freezing of embryos is going to be a lot more successful when you're counseling that patient. You know, should I do egg freezing or should I do embryo freezing? Definitely the pendulum favors embryo freezing at this stage. But unfortunately, that requires a partner or some type of sperm source, and which isn't always available from a social standpoint, especially in a woman who's been diagnosed with cancer and who has no other options. So that's where egg cryopreservation becomes the only option for that woman.
Yeah, and we kind of skipped over it, as I understand this, as well as one of the other factors that's happening as women age is the number of eggs are perhaps decreasing, but the quality, some genetic risks are beginning to creep in, so that if you could protect those eggs early and save them by freezing, you really protect the quality of the egg from as a younger person as well. So that's another reason to think about this, I guess.
Exactly. With women, you know, waiting for to get pregnant, you know, they are waiting and assuming the diminished egg quality that concerns many women. I tell you, I have many consultations with women who not only are concerned about getting pregnant themselves at all, but they're concerned about the health of the child. You know, they're over 35, they're over 40, they've seen the statistics that are available online about the risk of Down syndrome, about the risk of aneuploidy, and it deeply concerns them, as it should be, because in the end, they want to have a healthy child. I mean, that's what we're looking for. And you do jeopardize that as you wait.
Remind our listeners once again, if you've got questions or comments about infertility or in vitro fertilization, this is a great time to be calling and asking your questions. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us during the program at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. I assume, and I'm pretty sure the answer is yes, that we've gotten, or you guys have gotten, medicine has gotten much better at the genetic aspects of this, at looking at these eggs and embryos and being able to identify the quality and worry it in a much more sophisticated and accurate way as well.
Yeah, Thad, the answer is yes and no. I mean, yes, we have gotten really, really good at grading the embryos and resulting in what I call a qualitative outcome. You know, you're either going to get pregnant or you're not going to get pregnant. We're very, very good at doing that by, you know, getting a cohort of eggs during an IVF process, fertilizing them, growing them as embryos in our laboratory, and then subsequently grading them so that we give that couple the best chance of getting pregnant. From a genetic standpoint, we are limited by what the couple is able to give us. And so we haven't changed the biological variables that go into that, the miscarriage rates, the risk of Down syndrome, the risk of overall aneuploidy, because those are all related to the egg quality and the sperm quality. So we are very good at getting people successes, it'll only improve as we learn the needs of the embryos in our laboratory and being able to grow these embryos well. But in the end, when we put those embryos in, miscarriage rates stay the same, and aneuploidy rates and Down syndrome risk all stay the same relative to the woman's age and egg quality.
Dr. Lynn, we're just about halfway through the program. I'm going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. I want to remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And during the program, you can email us at lineone, lineone, at kska.org. After this short break, we'll continue to take any calls and emails and talk with Seattle infertility expert Dr. Paul Lynn on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Paul Lynn. Dr. Lynn's specialty is the management of infertility, and we're talking about some recent new developments in this field, and also we hope to get into in vitro fertilization. If you've got questions or comments, you need to get on the phone or get on that computer and email us right now. As you probably know, we will not be able to answer questions if you're listening at our taped rebroadcast later today. tonight between 7 and 8. Our email address is line1@kska.org. Our local number, 550-8433. And outside of Anchorage, we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Let's talk about infertility for a minute. Is there a fairly common scenario or a couple of common scenarios of people or couples that are coming to you for infertility?
Oh, it gets a lot of play, in vitro fertilization. That is, it takes a majority of the work of our staff, but in all honesty, and I tell all the patients about IVF as an option, but there are a lot of other ways that you can get a woman pregnant without having to do IVF, and I speak specifically to artificial insemination. So if a woman comes in and she's done a standard workup, everything, based on that workup appears to be appropriate, IVF is an option, but it's not the option that most people have to go to. We get a large majority of patients, and in fact, I would say upwards of half of the patients pregnant before they have to do IVF. And so IVF is always an option, but it's not the only option for women.
Okay. Let's talk about the infertility reasons that bring them to you in the first place. What are the common situations?
Yeah, well, the most common scenario is a combination of a lot of little things. It's what we call multifactorial infertility, where you have, a somewhat low sperm count, or you have a slightly low antral follicle count that I talked about, or you have a slightly elevated FSH value, or you have a slightly low progesterone value. So or one tube is blocked rather than both tubes being blocked. So it's usually a combination of a lot of little things that prevent that woman from getting pregnant, all of which need attention, all of which need correction that will eventually get that couple to get pregnant. So there's sperm issues, there's blocked tubes, there's low progesterone, and the most common one, if you had to put someone, most common is going to be age.
So in this day and age, where we're always in a hurry to get there in a rapid
yes.
way, is there a kind of a typical approach where there's a number of tests that are aimed at the most common issues all done at one
yes.
time, and then or do we stage this thing working up, so to speak?
Well, by the time someone has come to see someone like me, certainly it can be staged, of course, but as time goes along, really it is best to get all the information up front, and usually that workup takes about a month to do. So the specific tests are a day 3 FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, an estradiol, an anti-malarian hormone, all of which are usually done on day 3 of a woman's menstrual flow, with day 1 being the first day of flow. So that's one test. Then the other test that a lot of people do is what's called a hysterosalpingogram, an HSG as we call it for short. That is a radiological procedure, an X-ray basically, of dye going inside the uterus, inside the fallopian tubes, and we take pictures of this dye going through the reproductive system, confirming not only the integrity of the uterine cavity, making sure it's free and clear of any pathology, but more importantly, making sure the fallopian tubes are open, that the conduit for sperm to get to where the ovaries are, where the egg is ovulating, is open. Then the third test is the sperm analysis. An analysis of the count, an analysis of the motility or how well the sperm are swimming, and an assessment of the morphology or how well shaped the sperm are. The fourth test that we do to complete the workup is what we call a progesterone test, where we test progesterone production, progesterone levels in the blood during the luteal phase, which occurs specifically 5 to 9 days after ovulation. So a woman determines when they're ovulating, and then they come into the office for progesterone blood values that can be checked during this luteal phase. And with that, you're going to probably pick up a combination of one or two of these abnormalities 85% of the time. 85% of the time, 15% of the time, this workup is completely normal, and it's a very frustrating diagnosis where we call it unexplained. Mm-hmm. Unexplained. We've done all the tests available, and we still don't see why it's not happening for them.
Then what? In the unknowns, what's the next situation?
Well, at that stage, we initiate what's called empiric treatment, where we don't know what we're really treating, but we're going to undertake therapy that we know works, that we know in well-documented research by doing this therapy, whether it be an easy-to-take drug called Clomid, or an easy process called artificial inseminations, where the man presents to the office and collects a specimen, and a processing of the sperm occurs, and then the deposition of that sperm is deposited in the woman's uterus, intrauterine insemination. We know that we're able to improve a woman's ability to get pregnant on a per-cycle basis. So we initiate this empiric therapy. We do this process, depending on their age, anywhere from 3 cycles to 6 total cycles, with 1 cycle being defined as from 1 menstrual cycle to the next.
Are those kind of options available? I'm just thinking about, again, people in Anchorage. Is that an option here if the evaluation's been done here or they are down with you all and nothing is found? Is that something that's locally available, I guess is what I'm trying to get at?
Yes, it is locally available. There are specific obstetric and gynecological practice that are available in Anchorage who are able to do this work. The only downside is that if you do live somewhere outside of Anchorage or outside, you know, in Kodiak or Juneau or these areas where the facilities aren't available to you, you have to come to Anchorage to do this kind of work. And because the work needs to be done during a specific time of the cycle, it can be a logistical nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Based on not knowing when a woman's going to ovulate. And then you have to respond pretty quickly. You know, that woman checks a predictor kit, and then within 24 hours, 40 hours, that woman is going to ovulate. So the timing is very essential in getting this work done specifically. And if someone is out in the far reaches of Alaska, can be very, very difficult.
We've focused up to this point on women in particular. What about men? What happens with their ability to initiate a pregnancy with age, the quality of the sperm compared with like quality of eggs? We've talked about the genetic issues, and then some of the other issues that men may have that are affecting this ability to become pregnant.
Right. Well, Thad, unfortunately, life is not fair, and women get the short end of the deal here. When I talked about earlier in the show that women are born with their entire allotment, I meant they were born with their entire allotment of eggs. With men, it regenerates.
Okay.
It regenerates. Right. And the man is able to fertilize and produce sperm with good production well into their 50s and 60s. And so the quality of that sperm regenerates, their germ cells develop, and so this is why men can have children when they're a little bit older. But a woman's 35 years of age is a man's 50 years of age. So they're not fertile like they were 20 years ago, and I think you and I realize that personally. But a 50-year-old, a 55-year-old is going to always have a little bit of a compromise in their ability to overall conceive. But we have revolutionized male infertility with a process called intracytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI. This is a procedure that is done in the laboratory during an IVF cycle. So a woman undergoes an IVF cycle. The man is considered, quote-unquote, infertile by every definition, but we only need 5 or 10 sperm to be able to fertilize those eggs appropriately with this procedure. It's taking the egg itself, it's taking the sperm itself, and with a microscopic needle, we're able to inject the sperm into the egg themselves. And this has revolutionized fertility practice starting in 1991 when this procedure was initially started.
Let me remind our listeners once again, and I do have one email we're going to address in a second, but let me just make sure our listeners know you can reach us by calling 550-8433, our outside number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@kska.org. And my guest is Dr. Paul Lynn. We're talking about infertility in vitro fertilization. This may be off the subject. I find it kind of interesting in that I recall something about this, but the whole idea of the sperm being able to get into the egg is I don't know if it's something you're prepared to be able to discuss. When you talked about how you're able to inject with a small pipette or needle the sperm
right.
directly into the egg, we think that that's kind of an automatic thing for sperms getting into the egg, but that can be a problem in itself, I think, can it?
Oh, it definitely can. You know, during natural conception, you know, it's a quantitative thing. The ability of sperm to even get to where the egg is, that's going to be a major problem during natural conception. But when you do have a struggle with the ability, and this is related to egg quality, so a good egg quality, more so than sperm quality, a good egg is going to be more easily fertilizable than a bad egg. And usually it's due to the hardness of what we call the zona pellucida, which is the eggshell portion of the egg. If you've ever seen a picture of an egg, it's one big cell with a membrane surrounding that. It's the hardness of that zona pellucida that prevents proper insemination of a sperm to embed itself and drive itself through that zona pellucida. With ICSI, we're able to overcome that issue. We're able to overcome that issue that prevents men who have low sperm counts the ability to fertilize that egg properly.
Mm-hmm. Seems like I vaguely remember also that once one sperm finally does make it through that membrane, that there's an automatic rapid change in the cell to make it almost impenetrable by other sperm, kind of decreasing the risk of multiple pregnancies. Is that true too?
Right. Right. It's called capacitation, where there's a molecular process that occurs, of which we have very little understanding overall that, but.
Yeah.
I think what it does is it prevents polyspermia from occurring, where you have multiple sperm, fertilizing that egg. It kind of shuts the gate and says no more. And polyspermia is an issue, and it can affect an embryo's ability to grow if you have more than one sperm. So there is a biological reason for this capacitation to occur, for the sperm to stop multi-sperm from fertilizing.
Very, very interesting. We have a caller, Richard, on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, there's an issue that has arisen into the public knowledge that seems to be getting different pieces of information as to the age of a male at which it is unwise to participate in in having more children, because of the fact that the odds of birth defects like Down syndrome coming from defective male sperm go way up, actually. And I'd like to hear about that more, what the latest info is on that.
Okay, good question.
And I can take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks for the call.
Yeah,
thank you
very much.
Right now, a lot of the data is based epidemiologically, where you got to have an X number of guys trying to get pregnant over a span of time in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And you can see, for social reasons, this isn't happening very, very commonly at all. So the data is very, very limited. And we do, just because there's not many guys out there who, at 50, 60 are trying to have kids. And if they're trying to do it, through an IVF scenario, which is already a very artificial scenario. So there is concern, at least in our specialty, about older men having children. But so far, we don't have any specific age cutoffs that have been recommended by a reproductive society. Because if there were some age cutoffs, that would then state to you guys, the lay public, that we do have concern about aneuploidy and Down syndrome, but there is really nothing out there specifically like we know about women, where there's very specific, you know, 1 in 40 chance a 40-year-old woman has, you know, a chance of having Down syndrome like we do with men. So I think the jury's still out there on it, Thad, in regards to specific numbers that we can quote.
What do you mean by aneuploidy?
Aneuploidy is an overall generalized term where Down syndrome being the classic example of where there is a redundancy or an extra chromosome or a deficient chromosome that results in the resulting embryo or child having a genetic issue that affects the ability to conceive for that embryo or miscarriage rates. We use it as a overall term to describe those genetic issues that arise.
Okay. Here's an email from a couple. I'm going to see if I can read that to you. And basically, it gets down to the issue of this cryopreservation. It says, we went through an IVF treatment and initially had 31 eggs retrieved. 28 were fertilized successfully. Two embryos were transplanted, resulting in a successful pregnancy. 12 eggs were frozen, and it says the 2PN stage, which may,
yep.
I think, doesn't mean anything to me. Hopefully,
it doesn't mean anything to you, right?
And
it means a lot to me.
Okay.
It means a lot to me.
2PN stage, and the remaining 14 were frozen several days later. When we tried several years later for a second pregnancy, several times using these frozen embryos, none of the embryos survived the thawing process. Would this be indicative of a problem with the freezing process? It seems most people have success with using frozen embryos. Thank you.
Yes. You know, unfortunately, absolutely not. It does not, because it goes back to the biology of the whole scenario where there's huge, huge inefficiencies that are faced. So if this woman, you know, produced tremendous numbers, 31, 28 embryos, with a large number of eggs developed, that is going to follow in line with what happens naturally. What IVF does with hormones and hormone shots is it increases the number of eggs that are available, but does not increase the efficiency, the natural inefficiency that reproduction produces. So when you do the math down the road, you know, 31 eggs, I would have expected maybe five or so embryos available with the process. Two is not that far off of the five.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing this woman's age, again, it's a quantity versus qualitative issue. We can produce lots of eggs, but the quality of the eggs that are there may not be optimal.
Mm-hmm.
So two is certainly well within the realm of natural biological variation with the number of eggs that this woman obtained during an IVF cycle. And it takes a lot of education. We're getting better at it. I could tell you when we started doing IVF, you know, in 1978, we are learning about the inefficiencies that IVF creates, and we're trying to set up our patients with expectations. You know, there's a large part of our IVF population where we have to sit down with our patients and discuss with them what the expectations are in the embryology lab, that we may get 20 eggs, but in the end, what we're going to have that's fertilizable, that's transferable, and what is freezable are going to be, you know, very low compared to the original egg number.
And we talked a little bit before we came on the air about some techniques that are coming down the line that really improve our ability to look at the egg quality or the genetic quality, which is a big factor in success. And so that things may get better or anticipated to get better and better.
May get better, yeah.
Okay. Here's a great question I should have addressed earlier. How is infertility defined? Does a woman have to be actively trying to get pregnant for 6 months, a year, 2 years? In other words, when should a woman come to a clinic for help? How would you define infertility? Or if that's undefinable, then when should women start thinking about this?
Yeah. When you go by the book, it's 1 year of trying.
Okay.
That's the classic definition. However, over the years, that definition has evolved, where over the age of 35, a woman who has been trying, quote-unquote, trying, whatever that means to that woman, but usually it means to me not contracepting, is 6 months. Over the age of 35, if a woman has been, if a couple has been trying for 6 months, they should present to their family practitioner or OBGYN physician describing their struggle, because time is not on their side with that couple who's over the age of 35. And then they initiate the workup that I've mentioned before. Depending on the family physician or OBGYN, they may decide to refer on immediately to us for that workup, as this is what we do on a day-to-day basis. We get a lot of referrals, you know, from our local OBGYNs, as well as from Alaska and from other areas of the Pacific Northwest. But we also get a lot of patients who come in directly, just direct to consumer, you know, kind of approach, where they know they need a specialist's help in regards to doing the workup, and they're just cutting to the chase because they know that time is not on their side.
Okay. Got another email, and that is, the question is, could you talk a little bit about the success of reversing vasectomy? Is that nowadays pretty successful, and how does it affect the whole issue of fertility?
Yeah, my male colleagues, urologists, are more equipped to answer that question, but I could tell you from talking with Dr. Dale McClure and Tom Walsh, who are local urologists who see patients in our facility and can properly counsel this patient with who actually do the procedure, I could tell you that it depends a lot on age, how long ago the vasectomy was performed, as well as possibly the hormonal profile of that man. You know, I talked about a hormonal profile of a woman in assessing her fertility assessment. There are hormones that can be checked on a man to assess the sperm production that's going on. Because obviously, if the vasectomy has been performed, we're not able to do a proper semen analysis. So hormonal assessment is the only indicator that we can do to assess what is the fertility potential of that man. But I could tell you that, you know, Dr. McClure and Dr. Tom Walsh are one of the leading fertility experts in the urology field and are very, very good at reversing vasectomies with very good success. I don't want to speak for them, but opening the vasectomy, you know, making it patent is upwards of 90%+. And then follow-up semen analyses are done to assess what kind of sperm production is being made post-vasectomy reversal.
So the critical factors here I'm hearing you say is, like many things, it's much more complex than you think, but one of them is the reliability, the experience, the quality of the reconstruction of the
Absolutely. This is not surgery, vasectomy reversal is not a procedure that should be done by your run-of-the-mill urologist. It takes some due diligence on the patient's part to really assess the qualifications of the urologist that they are consulting with and making sure that they do this on a regular basis. Because the more you do it, the better that you get at it and the more success that you have at it.
We're getting a couple more questions relating to men, and you may not be able to answer this one, but it's an email. It says,
sure.
We have a person who has emailed about retrograde ejaculation in diabetics. Is this common? Do you know anything about it? Any advances? What are your comments?
It's very common. It's very common. Diabetes is a neurological issue. It causes neurological damage as a result of the diabetes itself. So you're going to have inappropriate ejaculation occurring retrograde, backing up basically into the urine. There are ways to collect sperm in that man where they do a post-void ejaculate where the man does ejaculate and then a urine sample is collected, and through specialized andrology techniques we're able to collect sperm appropriately from that urine specimen. The quality and the quantity of that sperm is oftentimes compromised, that a IVF scenario is usually necessary in order to maximize overall fertility for that couple who has a man where the sperm is unable to be ejaculated properly. And this you know, this couple might need additional direct consultation with Dale and with Tom, who do see patients in CI at our facility and can talk more about it specifically.
Okay. So, and this is probably more of a late stage diabetic problem, or
yes.
Not necessarily? Okay.
Well, not necessarily, but yeah. Yes, it can be, because you can have underlying occult diabetes that, for some reason, has affected the reproductive system more so than other aspects of diabetes.
Okay. We've just got a couple of minutes more. I've got a couple of questions here. I am always listening to podcasts, trying to find interesting programs, and I remember hearing something about blood type being related to fertility and ovarian reserve. Is that prime time yet, or still just research?
Not prime time. Not prime time. There's a lot of interest in finding the etiology of premature ovarian reserve decline, looking at various vaccinations, etc., and blood typing is just one of those fields that a lot of research is going into to find out why women lose their fertility potential sooner than other women.
Okay.
But it comes down to the crux of the issue is genetics. An underlying genetic issue that we have not found the genetic information that relates to premature ovarian failure, as we call it, to why some 35-year-olds get pregnant very easily, and why some 25-year-olds don't get pregnant at all. That's always the underlying question: is why am I struggling? Why am I struggling?
Mm-hmm. All right, we got about a minute and a half left. I've got, let me ask you this question. I see a lot of teenagers, and when once they go through puberty, we notice a variceal. What is a variceal, and from your standpoint, how is it related to infertility?
A varicocele?
Varicocele, yeah, I'm sorry.
Varicocele, yeah. A varicocele is basically a dilated blood vessel, blood vein within the testicle. And because temperature is so critical for proper spermatogenesis, this is where the, avoid saunas and avoid hot tubs and wear loose wear boxers and not white underwear, tighty whities as we call it. The same thing comes along with varicoceles, where you have an accumulation of blood, warm blood, that results in destruction and affecting the sperm quality. It's very, very debatable. Very, very debatable. Mm-hmm. I could tell you right now that we are not recommending varicolectomies or the correction of varicoceles for enhancement of fertility overall in mm-hmm. general. And so the jury is still out, but we haven't found that surgical correction actually enhances a woman's overall ability to conceive in a couple.
Okay. Well, let me say very much how much I appreciate your taking the time to be with us today, and good luck driving home.
You're welcome. We're getting a lot of snow down here. We cannot handle it down here like you guys up there.
All right. Well, hopefully we can handle the snow and ice. Thanks very much again. My thanks to Dr. Paul Lynn for joining us from Seattle to discuss infertility. Line 1 is going to be back next week, and we're going to have a local nephrologist, Dr. Jeremy Gittimer, and we'll be discussing hypertension. In the 10 years I've been doing this program, we have not addressed this issue. It's an extremely important one. So if you want to learn more about the causes, prevention, and treatment of hypertension, and perhaps some kidney stone issues if we get a chance, join us next week. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. Thanks for listening, and especially to those of you who called and took the time to email today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.